A man named Dave Rupert is, as it said in the wonderful new podcast by my two friends sitting here, Abdon Palish and Bob Hergeth, is no James Bond. That's something everybody says about him. I got to tell you something, fellas. I've listened to the first six episodes of this podcast, of the 12 that will be the podcast. This guy, to my mind, is in his way much more interesting, frankly, than the cartoon character who is James Bond. How did you find that? When is the first time you two guys, two of the most talented reporters have ever worked in this town, Abdon went on to a real job after many years as a reporter. How did you come upon Dave?
So Dave found us. What happened was Bob and I had been doing stories for the Sun-Times about this. The word breaks that Mickey McKevitt, the head of the real IRA, an IRA splinter group in Northern Ireland, that's when the rest of, you know, Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness is bringing these guys into the political world, the folks that want to keep throwing bombs are led by Mickey McKevitt, the real IRA, and they're trying to take down the peace process.
Sure.
They don't want peace. They want reunification.
In the 1990s.
Yeah. And so he's been arrested and charged with directing terrorism, and the main witness against him is going to be a Chicago trucker named Dave Rupert. And Bob and I look at each other like, who the hell is Dave Rupert? We know everybody who's Irish in Chicago.
Exactly.
We don't know Dave Rupert.
Exactly.
So we start going out because we know some of these folks that are in these fringe groups that he's been infiltrating, and we start talking to them about, tell us about Dave Rupert. And they're minimizing, you know, Frank O'Neill, Beckett O'Neill's pub on North Avenue. Oh, he may have come into a couple meetings and set up a few chairs, but he didn't really do anything. They knew him pretty well. So then Rupert wants to tell his story. So he reaches out to the reporter with the most Irish name in Chicago journalism, Flynn McRoberts.
A good reporter, too.
He's a great reporter. And Flynn, you know, says, hey, my buddy Abdon's really into his Irish stuff. So he brings me on. So Flynn and I go to meet Dave in an undisclosed location. And we let him know, okay, if we're going to do this book on you, we're going to do the whole story.
Just tell me it wasn't a bar, though.
No. It was a lawyer's office. We're going to do the full story, warts and all, your divorces, your bankruptcies. He was cool with all that. He said, sure, that's fine. Tell it all. And so we start meeting with him, and we click on the tape recorder and say, tell us a story. Because, you know, you want to know, was he a mole to begin with? Was he a true believer who flipped? We didn't know. And
where
we
are you
find
from?
Him.
You're not from Chicago. I mean, there are a lot of questions that you had to ask immediately.
And Flynn had to step off to work on another book. So Bob, who'd been working on the stories with me, jumps in. And then the two of us take over what was to be a book project. The book didn't happen. But all these years later now, the podcast is even more fun than probably the book would have been.
The basis of the podcast, and you can listen to it, you just go to the website, Entropy Media, that's entropymedia.art, and you'll find it. It's called The Rebel Kind. This is the first in what I suppose will be a series, unless it ends with you guys. There have been two of these things. This is by far, I listened to some of the first one, and it does not live up to this one. You can listen to the whole thing. How can people can listen for free?
Yes.
See,
Spotify.
Take me deep into the podcast world. How does that work? I mean, there is obviously, and we'll get into it because you guys will be on for a whole hour. I can't even imagine how much work is involved in this because there are so many layers to this story. Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, it is not simply Abdon and Bob talking into a tape recorder and hearing what Dave Rupert has to say. There's music. There are other people interviewed. There's context for the Irish struggles. There's context for Chicago and weird Chicago politics. There's so much in it. How long did it take you to do that?
Started over 2 years ago, and also took Abdon and I independently, both to Ireland too, knocking on doors and doing a little reporting over there too. Plus, Abdon went to El Paso, and we did a lot of reporting, original reporting.
You guys went up north to meet some members of Dave's family.
Yeah, I went there 20 years ago, and again, sort of the foundation of this podcast or these tapes, you know, that we interviewed, you know, we recorded interviews with Dave 20, 25 years ago, and so we just held on to them. And but at that time, I went up and interviewed Dave's family in upstate New York.
Let me ask you, because my mind is getting old, did you guys do pieces for the papers?
Yeah, we did stories back then, 20 years ago.
Okay.
There were the initial stories on who Dave Rupert was, what the Chicago connection was to this IRA drama playing out in Ireland, in Northern Ireland. Then there was a story of the federal court case over our tapes, which there were stories about. And then things kind of went dormant for about 17, 18 years.
Wow.
Till Bob was talking to this Hollywood company.
Yeah.
How'd that come about? Who called you?
Well, there's the guy that runs this Entropy company that's producing and, you know, is doing this podcast with us. He's a Chicago guy, Andrzej Nagpol. He went to Fenwick High School, grew up Northwest Side guy, actually right by, I think, St. Pat's, right? Over that, that way. And very nice guy. And they just, so for the Sun-Times, where I work full-time, I built this database on FBI files where I'm collecting FBI files.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And then post them online. And this database now has a couple hundred of these, blah, 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 blah. And it's called the FBI files. And one day I get a call from somebody from Andrzej's company. They wonder, they Googled, you know, FBI files looking for something for their initial pilot podcast and said, do you have this, this FBI file? I said, no, but I can probably help you get it. So we got to talking and I kind of just helped them very loosely. And then the conversation went, look, we're going to be expanding. You know, do you have any ideas? And I suggested this as an idea, but not for us, frankly,
yeah,
because I was
yeah.
kind of this was such a torturous, horrible process
well,
that we went
imagine.
Through 20 years ago.
Well, I can't even imagine what it must have been like for you two to go back. I'm assuming you had not listened to the tapes for almost 20 years. We have to take a short break, but these two gentlemen, Bob Hergerth and Abdon Palish, are going to be here this whole hour trying to convince you. I hope you're doing it now. You can do it now. Go and look up entropymedia.art. That's entropymedia.art, and find the Rebel Kind, and you will be entertained for one, two, and how many are up now? Seven?
We got seven up now. There'll be a total of 12, one every Wednesday till first of June.
It's very exciting. We will explain my enthusiasm and the reasons for my enthusiasm about this, you know, this makeshift James Bond. We'll be back in a couple minutes. I am talking for this entire hour with Bob Hergerth, still with the Sun-Times, and Abdon Palish, formerly of a couple of great newspapers in this town. He now works for, he's in the political sphere, sort of
government.
Gone straight. Government, yeah, not politics. Government, yeah. Government. They are the creators, along with some people they will tell you about, of a beyond fascinating podcast called The Rebel Kind. It's kind of an edge of the seat. It was for me. I have only listened to the first five of what will be 12. It's an edge of the seat kind of narrative so far for me. This guy, let's talk about Dave for a while. He has a relatively, you hear this in the first few episodes, a relatively checkered past.
Yeah.
Is that a nice way of putting it?
Fair enough.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, he's really kind of a rascal, right? He kind of pushes the envelope.
First of all, let me stop you.
Yeah.
He is 6'7" and weighs 300 pounds.
Yeah, he's a physically imposing guy, and he's like, and he was big since he was little, as we say in the podcast. I mean, the guy, and so his nickname, that his family's nickname is Joby, which is short for Joe Beef, which is what his dad basically, I think, coined because he was such a big kid. And his size is really just, you know, he's just a very large guy. And he goes to Ireland, and he sticks out, and which is also part of the story, because not only is he not Irish, is he not Catholic, does he not have any sort of, you know, skin in the game in Ireland, but he's also this, like, physically imposing.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. That's big.
Yeah.
But people would stare at him on a street,
yeah.
walking down the street. He's from near Canada. Let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up in kind of rough and tumble kind of way, did he not?
He came up on the hard side.
Yeah, youngest of a large family, kind of, you know, that didn't have tons of money. And so he kind of scrapped to survive. And then he really learned how to do that through the family and through his upbringing. And that's really what played into a large part how I think he was a successful spy.
Well, before he came to Chicago, he worked as a lumberjack. Refresh my memory, because I was listening like all night long. A lumberjack and all sorts of
He owned some restaurants. He declared bankruptcy a couple times, you know, left
a lot of
people
wives.
Yes. tried his hand at everything and jumped from one thing into another, tried learning how to fly a plane to get over his fear of flying. Trucking was the main thing. He tried his hand at trucking, and he, you know, had a couple of successes, a couple of failures.
He was always thinking big, though. I mean, with the hovercrafts and
yeah. So he goes down to Florida.
Didn't he drive a Jaguar or a Cadillac or something?
DeLorean?
A DeLorean
and a Rolls Royce.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Because he lived large, you know, so he'd blow his money and then not be able to pay his bills, and he'd try the next big adventure. So the second episode, which I'm sure you listened to, it takes place in Florida. And it was fun for me to work on this because I used to write there for the Tampa Tribune.
Right.
So this all starts at my old haunt, the Harp and Thistle Pub on St. Pete Beach, which is a great place. It was a great place. Alas, it is closed. It is now Oyster Shuckers, which is not as much fun as the Harp and Thistle. And I, you know, we got the band that used to play this great husband and wife duo, Guinness the duo. Their music is wonderful. She has a beautiful voice, and Dave just wanders into this. Well, the hovercraft story is Dave's thinking he's living in Florida and watching these boats go out to international waters, saying, you know, I could have a hovercraft take people out to international waters where the gambling boats would drop there. And he gets this guy who's friends with South American dictators and this mob guy from New York, and let's hatch this scheme. And the mob guy is threatening to shove hot pokers up people's whatever, and the dictator guy is talking about having them executed, and they're both drunk and loud, and Dave realizes, okay, that's not going to work. So he walks down to the other side of St. Pete Beach, and he hears this beautiful music, and he walks into the Harp and Thistle, and hears this beautiful redhead, Linda Vaughn.
I know.
Who turns out to be a high-powered lobbyist. She was Paul Tsongas' campaign manager in Florida was that 2000? No, 98. So, 92. I'm getting back here. And she's the reason you can't smoke in Florida. She's taking on tobacco interests. She fights the guns. But he just sees her as a beautiful woman, but they hit it off because they're both interested in Ireland. They're talking about Ireland. They're talking about liberal politics. Says, let's go out in the veranda, get some fresh air. Things go very well. They start dating, and they go back to Ireland together, and she starts introducing him to these guys who are involved with the IRA that own pubs.
And
that's kind of how this all starts.
Well, he absolutely seems like, just from listening to him speak and listening to the way you weave this story, he sounds like one of these rare guys. Rare guys now, not so rare 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, who are comfortable in tavern settings. You know, a big personality, likes to talk. Let's jump ahead to he eventually winds up in Chicago. And he's running some kind of trucking firm. And somebody comes to see him. And I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, I was never a fan of podcasts until listening to this. It's better than a TV show, frankly. There are so many things going on. Someone comes in, and his secretary or someone goes, I'm not sure you want to see this person. And he's a little scared. Why is he a little scared?
Well, I mean, it turns out he's an FBI agent, right? And what's going through Dave, the protagonist's mind is, okay, what if among many things could this be about? And,
many things. He owes money to the $750,000 to the IRS.
Yeah, he has a huge IRS debt. He's been involved with some pretty shady things over the years. And so it's kind of, you know, this is not a guy who gets, like, nervous very easily, I don't think, and yet, you know, we're little nervous about this. And then the FBI agent Ed Buckley slaps down a photo on the desk and says, what are you doing with this guy? And it was him with a reputed IRA guy in Ireland. And Dave's thought is, oh, is that it? Okay, thank God.
Relief.
Like, you know, relief that it's only about terrorism. And and you know, because Dave doesn't, like I said, doesn't have a horse in this race. You know, he's not Irish. He's got a, you know, basically a girlfriend who was very
much Protestant.
Into it.
Yeah.
So he's not just, you know, he's there because his girlfriend's plural had taken him to Ireland. He sort of got ingratiated and became friends with some of these people. And so at one point the Irish cops took a photo, you know, because like anywhere else they do surveillance on these folks, and they took a photo of Dave with this reputed IRA figure, and it trickled back to the US, to the FBI, and they want to know what he knows about these guys. And he's like, well, whatever, you know, I hang out with them at the pub, and we're friendly, but you know. And they said, well, will you give us information? And that's kind of how it started.
And he says, here's my card.
Yes. Yep.
Basically, the guy eventually has to eat the card.
Yes.
What do you think? You guys know him. What? Obviously, there some of the motivation was he could get free airfare to Ireland. That's the least of it. My assumption is that during his entire run with the FBI, he made a considerable amount of money.
Oh, yes,
you
sure.
know, I look at the old FBI scams that worked and scams that didn't, and they tossed around a lot of dough. So money was certainly a motivating factor, but I have the feeling, and I've already gotten from the first five episodes, that this guy, he's not a foolhardy adventure seeker, but he's eager for experiences, I think.
I think we take the word foolhardy out of there. He is an adventure seeker.
Yeah.
He likes a good adventure. He likes a challenge. And he will stumble into it the way most people might, do a little more preparation. He'll just head first in. And some might call that foolish. Some might call that just an adventure seeker. But he's gotten away with so much that no one ever would have expected you could.
Yeah.
Here's
a
Protestant. These IRA masterminds that have a reputation for being sly and cunning and pretty good judges of...
And suspicious, too.
Yes.
I mean, they're naturally suspicious.
You have to be, right?
Yeah.
But when Dave walks in with Linda Vaughn on his arm, well, that's an introduction to these couple of guys, Joe O'Neill and Vincy Murray. And then they get to be friends with Vincy Murray and Joe O'Neill. So it's a series of, people that vouch for him as legit, in part just because he's... And the Irish police, when should call him?
Maybe I could do this. Maybe I could do this. We will get to, after the news at the bottom of the hour, how he winds up too much owning a bar.
Yes.
He winds up owning a bar. Basically, the FBI pays. He pays a little. He and his wife pay a little to get this bar. It is, as they say in the... book, then there are more characters in that bar than there are stools.
That's true.
And we will explain that as we continue on with Abdon Palish and Bob Hergus talking about their unbelievable The Rebel Kind podcast that is at entropymedia.art. If you're a fan of podcasts, you will love The Rebel Kind on entropymedia.art, entropymedia.art. If you have never heard a podcast, this will really, really, really open your eyes to what it possible to do. It is about a man, just an ordinary man. This is like a script out of Hitchcock.
Yeah.
An ordinary guy, trucker, not so ordinary because he's 6'7" and weighs 300 pounds, who becomes a spy for the FBI and the British government against terrorists in Northern Ireland, and buys a bar. He just has purchased a bar with the help of the with FBI dough called Drow's Inn, where he just lets things happen. It reminds me of The Mirage, too, the famous investigative series in Chicago.
Yeah, for sure.
Famous investigative series here. Do you think he had any, you guys know as well as anybody, any guilt about this? Do you think he, because these people, when you get close to some people, it's hard not to be affectionate on a certain level. What do you think about that, fellas?
I think he did. I think he had some. He liked a lot of these people that he was. Even Mickey McKevitt, who was the head of the Real IRA and who was branded very, very distinctly as a terrorist leader and was responsible for lots of death and murder. He spoke about really getting on with him, and getting along and liking him as well as some of the other lesser leaders. So I think there was probably some, regret, but that was probably overshadowed by the amount of money he made, which was in the millions.
Now, he testified in the trial, yes?
Yeah, and his testimony is what put Mickey McKevitt away.
And they wanted, the McKevitt people wanted your tapes, did they not? Talk about that for a second. That doesn't come up, I think, till episode 11 or something.
So I'm working as the federal courts reporter at the Sun-Times, and I notice my name on the docket. I'm like, why is my name on the docket for tomorrow morning? They're seeking an ex parte order to compel us to turn over our tapes. And, you know, we fought it, got some good lawyers who, you know, made our First Amendment arguments about why we shouldn't have to surrender these tapes that we've been, you know, sitting down and making with Dave. And we lost. And so we're going to appeal. You know, there was an order came down. We had to, you know, turn over our notes and tapes or face fines and jail time. And we're going to appeal to the Seventh Circuit. Within just a few hours, we're pacing back and forth like expectant fathers.
Sure.
I had told my 8-year-old son, you know, he says, "Will you be out in time for my birthday if you go to jail?" And within a few hours, the note came down from the Seventh Circuit that no, the appeal had been denied. We're not going to. And so we're like, okay, fine. We'll go to jail. We'll appeal this all the way up to. And our lawyers say no. The fact that this came down so quickly means that it would be a ruling against you that would have force of precedent. So your best bet here right now, all you've got is a district court opinion that's not going to, you know, screw other journalists in your situation. So just end it here, which we did. And on the 4th of July, Bob and I went up and secured our tapes from their Cheney-esque, you know, undisclosed locations, brought them down to the FBI, turned them over. The FBI spent the weekend listening to them to make sure there wouldn't be any national security problems.
Right.
They brought them over. They brought them over to Dublin, where McKevitt's lawyers listened to them and found that Dave wasn't saying anything different to us than what he had said on the stand. So McKevitt was, spoiler alert here, but listen to the podcast anyway. It's still good.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Well, they did use some of the tape to try and tarnish Dave on the stand. And just to be clear, it wasn't the FBI and the U.S. government that was... after our tapes and notes, it was the McKevitt's defense team in Ireland. Very unusual case because it originated overseas, and a federal judge here, though, compelled us to release to the defense team in a foreign land in this terrorism trial.
When is the last time you see, then, Dave Rupert?
It's been close to 20 years.
Yeah.
And do you say goodbye, good luck, or does he say, send me the money from the book contract?
The original deal was supposed to be a partnership where if there were profits, you know, we and Dave would share the money.
We're all co-authors.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became clear the book was – there were a lot of problems. The FBI was going to challenge everything we put in there. The book just sort of didn't happen. And Dave said
– Yeah, and Dave said in the end, he was very polite about it. He just said, guys, do what you want. You know, and so, which means he sort of absolved us of our arrangement, and then we tried still for a little bit to get the book published, but it was a very strange time, and nobody bid, and plus now our tapes are in the public record, and so we just sort of let it drop for 20 years until recently.
You are both, to my mind and the mind of many others, both terribly talented reporters and writers.
Oh, thank you.
The making of a podcast, especially one with this kind of depth and detail, is a vastly different creative animal than is writing a book. When you first, whoever this nice guy who went to Fenwick and owns Entropy Media got in touch with you and said, this is what I'd like to do, that must have taken a great amount of time. You must have had either an editor involved or a producer, basically, saying, look, I think, as I just told you off air, that there is such a depth to this. When you get people, there are 15-year-olds running around Chicago, if you say to them, you know, do you remember the trouble your grandfather went through? The trouble. They go, what kind of trouble? Parking ticket? What do you mean the trouble? That's vanished. You know, I don't think it's taught, and certainly not taught in public schools here. The level of detail in this about Northern Ireland and about the history of the Irish and the English is unbelievably valuable and told. You got great people to tell this. You got great people commenting. In this, you have professors, and they're not dull academics. They're lively folks. That must have been arduous but fun.
It's great.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, Evan and I, again, this is probably the story. I mean, I've been a journalist for 30 years, and I probably traveled more for this story, for this podcast, than anything I've ever done. I mean, we were both in Ireland, Northern Ireland, all over the country, basically, to get just to eyeball stuff and to interview people and whatnot. And yeah, I mean, and people also forget, people of a certain generation, but like when we were growing up, I mean, there were different flashpoints around the globe, right?
Sure.
Obviously, the Middle East, which is still, you know, goes without saying, but Northern Ireland was also a huge flashpoint, an intractable, unsolvable, seemingly.
And a heartbreaker.
And basically civil war. And that has been, you know, there's been relative peace now since 1998 or, you know, there's, and the guy who's the focus of our podcast is part of the reason for that. A large part.
Yeah.
And for everyone you hear us talking to on these tapes, there's at least one or two more that we talk to that wouldn't come on the tapes. But these IRA guys, believe it or not, they don't like me to sit down with me and let me put a microphone in their face.
Unbelievable, really.
So it's very informed. Bob and I have covered Ireland and Irish stuff, you know, for our whole careers. So we had a Rolodex full of folks. And then, you know, my son did, you know, a year at University College Dublin. He said, you got to talk to my professor. He's great. So we met him at Bewley's, and that's Professor Laffin.
Oh,
he did a great.
Oh, that guy's great.
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
So a lot of things came together for this. You know, we worked hard on this 20 years ago. We've been working hard for the last 2.5 years, traveling, you know, retracing Dave's steps, talking to a lot of the folks that he talked to.
What about the doing a podcast? There's an element of theatricality to it, and there's an element of acting to it, and there's an element of speaking to it. Did you practice? Were you coached? Because you really sound great at it, and it's not an easy thing to do, as you can tell from some of the lame podcasts in this town.
Oh, thank
Such
you.
A learning
sure,
curve,
no, I
though,
mean, it yeah. really it really yeah. works. And I've known you guys for a long time, and I say, well, you guys sound great. And it's not easy. You don't just sit in front of a microphone and start reading. You have to have a script. You had a script.
Yeah.
We all
were writers on this, too.
But this is all ad-libbed, yeah.
A real unsung hero in this is our producer, Dalton Main, who is a really nice, smart guy. And he wrote this with us. He recorded and really made us sound smarter than we are.
He's done podcasts, so he was able to explain to us, you know, we're newspaper reporters, so I want to get to the nut graph within the first minute.
Of course.
No, you got to save the nut graph. We have to go chronologically here. You can't say what happens to McCabot, so we got to keep people, you know, following the story as it happens. And that's at a bit of a learning curve. And they keep saying, you know, I'm a Chicago guy, talk fast. And Dalton keeps saying, slower, slower. An what? Hour before we came here, my wife says, why do you talk so slow on this stuff?
You will. I'm going to play. I have a little short trailer for the podcast that we will play after a short commercial break. So you can hear some of what we've been talking about. It is a fascinating edge of your seat story about, I think, one of the great, if complicated, heroes of my time. Welcome back. I'm going to just talk to these guys. We're not going to hear. You have to go hear for yourself what they sound like on The Rebel Kind, episode 2 of The Rebel Kind. It is entropymedia.art, entropymedia.art. When you Google The Rebel Kind, you'll get a band. There's some kind of band called The Rebel Kind. But that's not these guys. That is not these guys. There are all sorts of other levels to the story of Dave Rupert, a spy, a regular guy. I keep thinking of Hitchcock. This is so Hitchcockian
yes.
in its way. I don't think could have ever been played by Cary Grant, but that's that's another matter. And you know, and the other thing that comes up in this thing is it does indeed remind me of the Mirage, the famous Mirage sting operation run by Pam Zekman and Zay Smith and the Sun Times. They bought a bar on Well Street, opened it up, and saw the corruption flow. The Drow's Inn must be a tiny place, because I'm so taken with the line in your podcast where there are more characters than stools at that bar.
So we talk about how there's some severe drunks there at this bar, and they go out to St. Columba's Dryout Center in Sligo, and at one point they had five of Dave's best customers in the Dryout Center, and we had five people missing, there were only six stools. Now, the stools are in the front at the bar section, but there's an Irish, so you got the front bar section and the lounges in back. So on their busy nights when they'd have a band playing the Irish rebel music, you'd have a full house of, you know, 30 or 40 people carrying on there. And you're talking about James Bond. James Bond never had to mop up vomit.
Exactly. So. Yeah, he never had to clean. He never had to shut down, put stools on top of tables. And I don't know if the Drew's Inn served martinis shaken, not stirred. But you, what is that place like? You've been in there?
It still exists? It's The Drow's Inn, even though it was as well-built as McCormick Place, it burned to the ground. Would you believe it?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And they've rebuilt it. There's now a building there called the Selkie, and it's a very nice place, much nicer than the Drow's Inn, which was a dump. But the whole idea that you have the FBI, who is our domestic spy agency, paying $8,000 to open a bar on the Northern Ireland border for our friends in the British MI5, but this isn't in Britain. This isn't part of British-controlled Northern Ireland. This is in the Republic of Ireland, only letting one executive of the Irish police know about this. We're on shaky ground in a number of areas here.
Oh, no kidding. Talk to me for a second, fellas. Talk to me for... I want to get to the Mr. Pochard story, but talk to me about this FBI guy, Ed Buckley. He seems, with all due respect, Mr. Buckley, if you're still alive, nuts to me.
He is still alive. He did speak to us briefly for this because we have some people on tape being very critical of him, frankly. Not so much about the Dave Rupert situation, because Ed Buckley was the one who flipped Dave to, you know, start working for the FBI. Ultimately, that segued into British intelligence and was a very successful operation. But there were a couple of other less successful operations that happened before that. Ed Buckley was assigned to the FBI in Chicago. He was assigned to work on IRA matters, IRA fundraising and gun running, so Irish terrorism issues here, basically. And there were a couple of cases that he worked that were really he took a lot of heat for, and he should have. One was a gun running case out of a bar that no longer exists called the Irish Wolfhound, although there's a similar name place that's unrelated that does exist now. And that there was a gun running case that he brought with an informant who was very questionable, and he charged him, or the federal authorities charged several people in this case, and it ultimately collapsed, and it was seen as a pretty laughable case with very little evidence and really shaky witness. And so he took a lot of heat for that. And then there was another case that there was a double murder up on the North Shore.
That's a strange thing.
He tried to link this double murder to possible IRA, involvement based on the connections of a family member, and it was kind of laughable from the start, and it really was very damaging, I think, to some of the family members of the couple that was killed, and it turned out to just not be true, and so he had some baggage.
He just seems he wouldn't write the checks, would he? This guy.
Well, he had to authorize them, right?
Wow.
So he was the FBI. His task was to monitor the Irish American guns and money connection and try and put a halt to it. And there was he'd had a couple of bungles, and he needed a win, and he finds Rupert. Thinks he has his ticket in Rupert.
Yep.
And now Rupert is infiltrating, you know, the same time he's infiltrating the Irish groups in Ireland, he's infiltrating the support groups here in Chicago.
Sure.
And so he's in this one support group, and there's some wonderful Forrest Gump-like moments where he just sort of stumbles into history. And the FBI has set him up with a phony trucking office on Halstead, down in Canaryville. And so he teaches himself, he's got nothing else to do, so he teaches himself how to do websites. Websites are just becoming a thing. So some of the people, one of the girls in the Irish support, the group that's supporting these families of the Irish prisoners, gets herself appointed as campaign office manager for Glenn Pichard's office, where he's running for governor. This is back in 1998. Glenn Pichard, conservative Democrat from downstate, wonderful guy, still the head of the downstate Democrats. You know, he was kind of a long shot considered in this primary there against John Schmidt, some other better-known named people, Roland Burris. And all right, so he says to his handlers in the FBI, can I do this? And they said, all right, just don't mess it up. Well, he kind of messes it up. He goes in there, and Pichard only wants small donations, and he wants all his donors listed. And so Rupert, is composing the website and writing down all these things in an IRA safe house in Ireland. And Peshawar tells me years later, no, he never realized that his campaign website was composed in an IRA safe house in Ireland. And then the thing collapses, the website crashes, and Dave and his volunteers sort of have to walk away from it. And Peshawar goes on to win the primary. Nobody ever found out about it. It survives. But there's a number of things, and in a later episode, we'll get to the Ballad of El Paso and what happened there. That was also funny. But
What did you two guys learn? How long did it take you to make these? I know you weren't working on it every day, but when you listen to it, again, ladies and gentlemen, go to Entropy Media, ENTROPYMEDIA.art, and you'll find it. This was pretty labor-intensive, I have to believe. It is so layered and deep and fascinatingly so. How long, what was the process like?
Couple years, not straight through, of course. You know, we both have day jobs, but, you know, I mean, some weeks, 10, 20, 30 hours, but some weeks, you know, very minimal, you know, just on and off. But lately, over the past few months, been pretty, a lot of heavy lifting. And just one thing to piggyback on what Abden was saying, too, is that, you know, despite this FBI agent's bungles, you know, in the past, I mean, there was absolutely a pipeline between yes. Chicago and elsewhere in the U.S. and Ireland in terms of guns and money.
Oh, sure.
So, I mean, it
sure.
was, I mean, the IRA would not have existed in its form if not for America and American support from Irish Americans.
And Chicago.
And Chicago.
One other good quote when we were talking before about Bob, and it's about Rupert and Mickey McKevitt getting along pretty well. Rupert said, if it weren't for the fact that he was a mass murderer and I was a British agent, we'd have been the best of friends.
Oh, wow. What a character. The experience in general, now that it is up and people are listening to it, is it like seeing your byline on a story? Is there a deeper appreciation of what you've accomplished?
I think personally, it's something that I have not done before, and especially there are talks, you know, just sort of conceptually about it becoming a movie at some point. So that's just kind of fun and exciting. But it's funny. I mean, it has in some ways it has a broader reach than your average news story, but in some ways it's more of there's silence, so you don't hear back. There's not that give and take that you get from the reader or the listener or whatever that you would get, you know, at the Sun Times where I do my full time job. So it's a little different. It's fun though.
Once you all listen to it, you know, tell us if you like it or not.
Yeah.
Just Google your Underbelly, The Rebel Kind. You can find it on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, anywhere you find your finer podcasts, or go directly to the website that Rick's been giving you there, entropymedia.art.
What have you heard from some of your colleagues and or former colleagues, such as me? I think newspaper guys would be jealous of this, Matt, because it's so, it's so wonderfully different than a news story, because again, a news story, you read it and put it down, tell your cat that it's here, and you know, and it probably will. I mean, I'd like to think that it will have a life beyond this. I keep thinking, too bad Hitchcock's not alive, but there are a lot there are a lot of good directors out there, and it's a fantastic story. You guys can be really proud. You know, I've admired your work for years. Bob Hergis still writes for the Sun-Times, and Abden Palish worked for the Sun-Times and the Tribune, and now is in government.
Quote-unquote.
Is Flynn jealous? What's Flynn think of this?
Flynn, you know,
Flynn McRoberts, who was first approached because he had such an Irish-sounding name,
and he's an editor at Bloomberg right now.
Sure.
He's still doing great journalism, and their policies are a little more strict about side gigs like this. So he
and a wonderful human.
Yes, he is
a great guy,
and a nice wife and a nice kid. And,
yes,
and it's the whole Flynn's the whole package.
Yeah,
Flynn is the whole package. Fellas, thanks for coming in to do this.
Thanks so much for having me. I'll
keep you posted because, again, I've only listened to the first five, and I have seven more to go. And they're released every Wednesday?
Every Wednesday morning. Yeah.
Okay.
Until, I really appreciate this.
No, don't be silly. I love seeing you in other interviews, but sometimes, as much as I love television, 7 minutes just doesn't, you know, you don't hear about the drunks at the bar. You just never.
There are plenty of those.
You don't hear about the drunks at the bar. Take care, guys. Get home
safe. Thank you so much.